Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I'm really delighted to welcome you all today to the fourth edition of MIPIM UK. My name is Ronan Vaspar, and I am the director of MIPIM Markets. For this opening conference, we are very proud to welcome Mr. Paul Brundage and Mr. Tim Harford. Paul Brundage is Executive Vice President and Senior Managing Director Europe for Oxford Properties, but he is also the President of the British Property Federation. So Paul is the head of Oxford's London office and is responsible for overseeing and managing the execution of the company's European strategy with emphasis on continued growth of the team and expansion into European markets alongside the UK. I'm also happy to welcome Tim Harford, who will be introduced by Paul later on. So ladies and gentlemen, please join me in giving a warm welcome to Mr. Paul Brundage.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and Ronan, thank you very much for the kind introduction. On the back of stalemate that we're seeing happen in our Brexit discussions in Brussels, and some of the dire warnings that we're hearing from groups like the Bank of England and the OECD yesterday, I think it is very timely that we are here today at the Olympia to try to talk about the role that our industry can play as we move forward for the next decade and beyond. Notwithstanding this environment, global organizations like Oxford Properties have significant capital that we are looking to continue to invest in real estate, both in the UK and globally, versus other alternative opportunities that we have. In fact, we have upwards of 20% of our balance sheet that is currently invested in real estate and a similar amount that is currently invested in UK and Europe. So the MIPIM theme for the next couple of days is really quite appropriate, which is, how is the UK responding to the immediate challenges of the UK property market? What investment opportunities are available? And with Brexit on the horizon and a reshaped Europe, now is definitely the time to get insights from everybody who's here today around the next chapter for our industry. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about that backdrop and a little bit about the British Property Federation. BPF are delighted to be partners with both MIPIM UK today and MIPIM in Cannes. We believe it is really crucial to showcase the UK, but also to ensure that we've got the best and brightest representatives from our industry here at these events to collaborate, share ideas, both public and private sector. We have multiple forums, not just in London, but across the country, and are really truly pleased to be able to call ourselves the British Property Federation. And I can assure you, I've been to places in the UK that I had never imagined being, and there's a lot of excellent dialogue that is taking place. From a BPF perspective, following the Brexit vote in June of 16, we put forward a manifesto with five key priorities for the sector. The first was ensuring that we maintain confidence in the UK economy. The second was that we make sure we have investment in our critical infrastructure. The third is that we continue to be open and available for the skills that are necessary for business at large and for our industry specifically. The fourth is that we have the appropriate regulatory environment, whether that is at the local planning level or right up to national level, that we are engaged with government to ensure that we have that in place. And last, and certainly not least, which is a theme that I think will resonate through the conference today, is that we have appropriate housing for the nation. And we know that that is certainly a key area, and a key area of concern and a key area of focus for us. We spent a lot of time engaging with national government on these points, and we're hoping that we can actually channel these into a specific sector deal where we can itemize specific actions and an implementation plan. The biggest challenge that we have is for the government to appreciate what the property sector is and to ensure that we have the level of engagement. The auto sector has a deal, the pharma sector has a deal, and in fact, our industry touches so many different aspects. One of the challenges that we have is getting focused. And so I think those five key priorities that I outlined a minute ago are certainly resonating with multiple levels of government. This morning, we hosted a breakfast upstairs where Baroness Fairhead, who is the new Department of International Trade Minister for Trade, spoke to the partnership that the industry and that the BPF has with national government. And I will say that I was quite encouraged by their response. There's a lot of moving parts. And I think our role as an industry, certainly channeled through the British Property Federation, is to work on that partnership with government and make sure we have a voice. From a personal perspective, and we've tried, as we have presidents of the British Property Federation rotate through on one-year terms, to not have pet projects. But one of the particular areas of focus that I've wanted to emphasize this year was the phrase, I believe that diversity is our strength as a sector. We touch all asset classes, all geographies, multiple types of ownership, and are intrinsically linked to the social and economic fabric of the company, of the country. I believe, unfortunately, that one of the reasons that has led to the Brexit vote is that the diversity that exists in the country has not been recognized and not been embraced. And we've created extreme polarization and divergence of prosperity across the nation. So one of the things that we need to do is celebrate that diversity. And one of the things that we're trying to do at the British Property Federation is do that. We have to look in the mirror, however. And if I look around this room, we haven't done a super good job as an industry of representing the diversity of the nation. So the BPF has published a statement of diversity and inclusion, and we've partnered with four key groups to help us engage with the industry and frankly be credible in our pledge to do that as a sector and engage with government on that basis. Those four partnerships include Real Estate Balanced, focus on gender diversity, include Pathways to Property at Reading University, where I'm particularly passionate about, as I'm on the Henley Business School board, where we're going to promote the new entrance to our sector from a vastly different socioeconomic and cultural background than the people in this industry to date. With Purple, who represents the disabled community, and with Freehold, who represents the LGBT community. And I think it's a tremendous initiative on behalf of the BPF, and I encourage all of us to get behind these initiatives, and I think it truly links to the challenges we have at a national level, how we're trying to engage with government on Brexit and on an industrial strategy going forward, and I ask for your support. The question proposed by MIPIM UK as it relates to the immediate challenges, I think one of the most important things we can do, and I look around the trade hall today and I see many local authorities and regions of the nation represented. I think what's really important is that we strengthen those connections with local authorities and combined authorities, with our metro mayors, and with our local enterprise partnerships. And I really hope that this forum gives everybody an opportunity to be together and engage in those discussions. I think we've already made some great progress in this area. We would have stood up, and I'm looking at the BPF policy team, where I went out to a number of different regions and we talked about devolution following the Scottish referendum vote. And I would say that we've made material progress over the last 2 years of engaging with local authorities, talking about issues that matter to the nation. So it's a start. But I think we have a long way to go, and again, I think this forum today is a great opportunity for us to do that. So I hope that sets the context for the next couple of days. It's great to see so many people here early on a rainy morning. and I'm happy to take questions at the end. Thank you very much. It is my pleasure, as Ronan mentioned at the introduction, to introduce our first keynote speaker of this morning, Mr. Tim Harford. Tim is an economist, a writer, broadcaster. He's the author of the million-selling The Undercover Economist, and most recently of Messy and 50 Things That Made the Modern Economy. He's won awards for both Financial Times columns and the BBC radio series More or Less, which debunks dubious statistics wherever they may lurk. He's spoken at TED conferences, on the stand-up comedy circuit, which I'm looking forward to, and Sydney Opera House. And now he's here with us this morning. We are very privileged to have with us, so please welcome Mr. Tim Harford.
Thank you very much. Well, thank you, Mr. Kind. We've heard from Paul about, you know, what he wants the future to look like. And over the course of the next day, you're going to hear a lot of people, a lot of industry experts telling you what they think the future is going to be. And I suppose it's my job as an economist, and of course we have vast experience of forecasting, but my job to shed some kind of light on all of that. And so I want to talk to you about this problem that we economists face of trying to see into the future, and why we find it difficult, and whether there is a way to do it better than we currently do it. And I thought I would start by, if I may, telling you a little story about two of my favorite economists and how they tried to use their skills as economists to make forecasts, how they tried to use those forecasts to make money, and about what happened to them. So one of them needs no introduction at all, John Maynard Keynes, most famous economist of the 20th century. Even today, economists divide themselves into, you know, the Keynesians and the other lot. The other economist, less famous now, but he was a contemporary of Keynes's, and in his day, he was the most famous, the most celebrated economist on the planet. When the Wall Street Journal in the 1920s were trying to explain to an American audience who John Maynard Keynes was, it was obvious who the comparison should be made to. They said, well, if you want to understand who John Maynard Keynes is, he is England's Irving Fisher. So Irving Fisher, John Maynard Keynes, are our two heroes. They were very similar in many ways, went to top universities. Keynes went to Cambridge, not as good as Oxford, of course, but still worth celebrating. Won prizes there, won prizes for mathematics. Irving Fisher went to Yale, where he won prizes for maths, for classics. He even won prizes for rowing. He was this great strapping figure of a man. He had a goatee beard and he was a diet and exercise expert. He published a book in 1915 called How to Live, this is a mission from economists, you've got to admit. Sold 500,000 copies, great success. So great academic successes. They were great writers, both published these successful books, were both frequently printed in the newspapers. They were great speakers. So Fisher won prizes for debating. Keynes once gave a speech, was witnessed by a Canadian diplomat called Douglas Lapan, who later wrote, I am spellbound. Is this an angel or a human being? This is the most beautiful creature I have ever seen. I mean, we economists, we have that effect on people sometimes. This person... Are we doing okay with the mic? Do you want a handheld mic? It's the kind of person. This is the kind of person that John Maynard Keynes was. We better? Yeah, okay. So, you know, they had these things in common. They had their academic successes, hugely influential thinkers. But what I wanted to talk about was their forecasting record and their attempts to make economic forecasts in order to make investment profits. So, I mean, Fisher first. So Fisher's initial problem with trying to make money as an investor is that he didn't originally have any money. So his father had died of tuberculosis the week he went up to study at Yale. And his entire academic career as a student, he was doing tuition, he was trying to scrape together a little bit of money in order to support himself, pay his fees, support his mother, support his younger brother. You know, he knew what it was like to struggle financially. But shortly after he graduated from Yale, he became extremely rich. And you may be wondering how he achieved this, so I'm happy to share the trick with you. I advise, you know, anybody to follow in Fisher's footsteps. He married somebody incredibly rich, which really works very well. She was called Margaret Hazard. She was the heiress to basically a soap powder fortune. And they had this wedding, hundreds of guests, wedding cake about the size of this lectern, three different priests, a 15-month honeymoon. Those were the days. 15-month honeymoon, touring around Europe. So Fisher had this cash to invest. And he also started making money off his own bat. So he was an inventor. He invented the precursor to the Rolodex, which he called the Index Visible. He then sold that to Remington Rand, the stationery company, for the equivalent of $40 million in today's money. So that's pretty good. He made money from his writing. He also started to gather early inflation statistics. So this is 1915 or so. No good inflation statistics being gathered by the US government, but Fisher needed them for his academic theory. And of course, he had the money from the Rolodex and from his wife and from his writings. So he had money to start hiring statisticians to gather data on the price level and data on inflation. And pretty soon he realized that this data had a commercial value itself. So he formulated what he called the Index Number Institute. And the Index Number Institute began to sell inflation figures to Wall Street and to the newspapers. So he had a syndicated page published all around the United States called Professor Irving Fisher's business page with his data and with his forecasts and with his commentary. And on this business page, he began advising people how to invest their money. And what he said they should do is what Irving Fisher himself was doing. So Fisher was a technology bull. He believed that the American economy was being transformed by the embrace of technologies such as electrification, the internal combustion engine, bulk chemical processing. And in the 1920s, this was going to lead to a huge run-up in share prices, more productivity, more profits, more money for investors. And so Fisher advocated investing in equities. And the more money you borrowed to invest in equities, the more money, of course, you would make if equities went up. And in the 1920s, equities did go up. They went up and up and up, and Fisher bought, you know, a car and then a bigger car and then an even bigger car, and then he hired a chauffeur. And by 1928, he guts the family mansion on 460 Prospect Street in New Haven, Connecticut, and completely reconfigures it in the most luxurious fashion. And he's standing outside this mansion with his son, and he points out to him, this is very important to Fisher, points out to him that all this investment has been paid for by Irving Fisher's own money. It's not his family money, it's not the wife's money, it's his money. And that mattered to him. So that's Irving Fisher, 1928. We'll leave him there for a moment. John Maynard Keynes. Well, Keynes, of course, didn't need to marry into money, which is probably just as well. Keynes had money, and his friends had money, and his father had money, and his father's friends had money. Everyone around him had money. He was the consummate insider. So Keynes traded currency and debt on behalf of the British Empire during the First World War. You really understand how markets work if that's your job. And at the end of the First World War, among many other things that he was doing, he was politically active, he was writing, He was academically active. Among many other things he was doing, Keynes started what we might call a hedge fund today to trade currency. He went to all of these people he knew who had cash, and he said, give me your money and I will trade currency and I'll make us all rich. Well, of course, you guys are already rich, so I'll make us even richer. So that's what he did. And for a while, things went very well. He made well over £1 million for himself in less than a year in today's money. It's not a bad start. But then, I mean, there's this statement that people sometimes attribute to Keynes, although he never said it, that the market can stay wrong longer than you can stay solvent. And the market took a very strange turn. And Keynes was wiped out. He was touring around post-war France buying Cezannes and Matisse's and Picasso's, and he gets this telegram saying there's been a brief spasm of optimism about the German economy's prospects. You bet that Germany was going down. Germany went up. All been wiped out. I mean, in the long run, Keynes was completely correct about Germany's prospects in the 1920s, but in the short run, he was wrong for long enough to lose everything. So this is awkward, because he's lost all his friends' money. But remember, Keynes is this great charismatic speaker, so he just phones up all his friends, he goes around to see them, and he says, look, sorry about losing all the cash. Give me more money, and I will make it all back. Remarkably, they did, in fact, give him more money, and even more remarkably, he did make it all back. So now by 1922, Keynes has made a fortune, lost a fortune, made another fortune. And for an encore, he turns to longer term investments. In particular, he wants to invest on behalf of his college, King's College, Cambridge. Now, King's College, Cambridge at the time, all their investments are in government gilts and agriculture. Basically, it's a very, very conservative long-term portfolio. And Keynes says, look, there's this new asset class called equities, and we should really have a piece of it. And we should also be investing in commodities, you know, copper, rubber, this sort of thing. Just hand over control of the college's portfolio to me. I am, after all, John Maynard Keynes, and it'll all be fine. And so Keynes started trading on behalf of King's College Cambridge. So Keynes's idea, it's very simple. He's going to forecast the economic cycle. He'll forecast the booms and he'll forecast the busts. And as the economy booms and busts, he will move into and out of the pro-cyclical and counter-cyclical sectors. That's how he's going to make money. Now, you might ask, well, how is he going to forecast the booms and the busts? Well, shouldn't be a problem. He's John Maynard Keynes. He is contributing to the gathering of economic statistics in the UK. He's literally written the book on macroeconomics. He's also the consummate insider. So Keynes would get phone calls from the Bank of England. No, Maynard. Yeah, it's the bank here. Interest rates going up tomorrow. There's a good chap. I mean, this is all legal at the time, but as you can imagine, might give you an edge when you're trying to predict what the economy is going to do. So this is John Maynard Keynes. We've seen what Irving Fisher is doing. Now, it's 1928. Our heroes are standing on the edge of an economic precipice. So it's the Wall Street crash, late 1929, wipes 89% off the value of the Dow Jones. 89%. That's a proper crash. None of this, you know, Lehman Brothers rubbish. A real crash. And then it's followed by the Great Depression, which is the single most important peacetime crisis of the 20th century. And our heroes, John Maynard Keynes and Irving Fisher, do not see it coming. This is the most important financial and economic event of their lifetimes. They do not see it coming, and they are the greatest economists on the planet, the pair of them. Now, some of you may not be that surprised by any of this because you may have met a few economists in your time. And you realize that we economists, we don't always have a great track record in forecasting economic downturns. Now, I mean, it may not, it's not just anecdotal. I mean, you know, you can all think of times that economists have made forecasts they haven't worked out. There have been some serious studies of this. So Prakash Lunghani, who is an economist at the International Monetary Fund, basically studied how many times economists across the public and private sector had successfully forecast recessions during the 1990s. So all these different countries all over the world, do we anticipate when they're going into recession? And he said the forecasting failure record is completely unblemished. They didn't manage to get a single one. So, I mean, this is not great. You then have the financial crisis of 2008, didn't contribute very much to the reputation of economists. And you might say, well, this is because it's a difficult problem. Of course it's hard. You know, we were forecasting that the Bank of England would definitely not raise interest rates as recently as mid-September. Now, 4 weeks on, we're saying the Bank of England is very likely to raise interest rates. I mean, who can account for how the Bank of England are going to change their minds? You look at the Brexit vote. But first, to get that one right, first you have to correctly forecast what the vote's going to be. Then you have to correctly forecast what the effects of the vote are going to be. And since the current cabinet doesn't seem to know what Brexit looks like at the moment, it's kind of difficult for we economists to know. Now, this is a hard problem. But still, you might say, well, these are all just excuses. There was a study published in 2005 that, to me, really drove home the challenges of forecasting. And it's one of my favorite studies in the social sciences. It was published by a gentleman called Philip Tetlock, who's not an economist, he's a psychologist. And what Tetlock had done in the 1980s is he'd become interested in, well, it wasn't actually economics at all. At the time, he was looking at the problem of thermonuclear war, which thankfully there's no prospect of thermonuclear war now, so we can all forget about that. That's good. But at the time, it seemed to be a live issue, the 1980s. And Tetlock went to talk to all the leading experts on the Cold War, all the people who watched the Soviet Union, people who studied American foreign policy, academics and diplomats and spies and journalists, the political scientists, historians, Sovietologists, all of these different people. And he interviewed them, and he realized they were basically split down the middle. Half of them thought the Cold War was going to heat up very, very quickly, and the other half thought that the Soviet Union was on the verge of collapse. Now, of course, we know which half was correct with the benefit of hindsight. But for Tetlock in the mid-1980s, he said, this is a problem. I'm going and I'm talking to the very best people in the world. They're making this forecast, and half of them are wrong. And I don't know which half. It seemed to him unacceptable that you could go to experts and ask for a forecast, and this is the performance they give you. And so Tetlock launched this very long-term project to evaluate expertise by evaluating expert forecasts. And what he did, I think, was quietly brilliant. He rounded up 300 different experts across all kinds of different fields, some of them economists like me, some of them political scientists, historians, all sorts of different fields. And he asked them to make specific forecasts. Not the kind of vague forecasts you so often see. I mean, oh, well, you know, Macron may be, you know, politically challenged in France over the next year or so. Well, what does it mean to be politically challenged? All politicians are politically challenged. It's just a meaningless forecast. So Tetlock says, no, I want you to make forecasts, and there'll be a date, an expiry date on each of these forecasts, and they'll all be quantifiable, so that by the time we get to the expiry date, we will know, yes, your forecast came true, or no, your forecast did not come true. And he gathered nearly 30,000 different forecasts from his 300 experts. And he did one other brilliant thing, which was to wait. Tetlock waited 18 years to see whether the forecast came true or not. And this is a wonderfully patient piece of research. And when he finally published his findings, 2005, great book called Expert Political Judgment, his conclusion, well, I mean, it's a brilliant and subtle and self-critical book with many, you know, nuances, but I'm going to oversimplify. What Tetlock found in 2005 was that if you really want a forecast of one of the big picture issues, macroeconomics, geopolitics, that sort of thing, well, London Zoo is that way. get yourself a chimpanzee. They're just as good as any expert you can find. You might as well just hire dart-throwing monkeys. Their prices are more competitive than most experts, and they don't do anything. The forecasting record is no worse. So that really, for those who are paying attention, you didn't need the financial crash of 2008 to discredit forecasters. You just needed to carefully read Tetlock in 2005. And for a lot of people, that was it. Forecasting is like Pringles. I mean, it's kind of a bit addictive, but no one is actually under the illusion that it's doing us any good, right? We're just another forecast and another forecast. But there was one person. There was one person who didn't give up on the prospect of forecasting. And that person was Philip Tetlock himself. The man who apparently had so brilliantly discredited all forecasting across all disciplines. So on the 1st of April, it's a great day for anything to happen, on the 1st of April 2013, Phil Tetlock emailed me and said, I've got a new forecasting project. Do you want to participate? And I should say right off the bat, I'm far too much of a coward. So I said no. But 20,000 people did say yes. And what Tetlock was doing was he was rerunning his forecasting tournament with the help of funding from the US intelligence services. But he was going to make it even bigger, and he was going to give different people in this tournament different kinds of training. He was going to subject everybody to a battery of tests. Some people would forecast in teams, some people would forecast as individuals, some people would use betting markets, all kinds of different technologies and tests they were being subjected to. And Tetlock recently published his findings. And his findings, to my astonishment, were that it is, in fact, possible to see into the future. It's not easy. Most of us can't do it. But some people can. And the people that Tetlock had identified as being able to do it had actually got better and better over the course of his four-year forecasting tournament. Rather than some fluke which regressed back to the average, they were actually sharpening their skills and improving them. And Tetlock called these people super forecasters, which I think is a little bit of a bit of hype, because they're not that good. They're just way, way better than the rest of us. So you might ask yourself, what does it take? What did these super forecasters do that made them more effective than almost everyone else? Well, the first thing that they did was they kept score. They're actually constantly looking back and asking themselves, how did last month's forecast go? How did last year's forecast go? Which is a very painful habit to acquire, because, I mean, whenever I look back at all the things I did wrong I'm 44 now. Well, that's 44 years of unbroken idiocy. I don't want to look back and learn from my mistakes. That's just being human. But Tetlock super forecasters did. They were constantly interrogating their previous forecasting performance. The second thing they did was they had a basic sense of how statistics worked. So when they were trying to figure out whether something was going to happen, the first thing they would ask is, well, how often does this kind of thing happen? So you're trying to figure out whether there's going to be a debt crisis in a particular country. You say, well, how often do debt crises happen in this kind of country? You're trying to figure out whether a dictator is going to be deposed. Is Kim Jong-un going to survive the year? But you say, well, how often do dictators in totalitarian communist states get toppled? Not very often. That just gives you a sense, a baseline, when you're starting to make your forecasts. How often do recessions happen? About 10% of the years that you might consider, an economy goes into recession. So when you're trying to forecast a recession in the UK or anywhere else, start by saying it's about 10% likely to happen in the next year. You might modify up or down, but if you start with the realistic baseline, you're going to do much better. But there was one thing that Tetlock found that was particularly powerful and strong predictor of the ability to forecast. Tetlock, remember, had given people IQ tests, personality tests, so he was trying to establish, do the optimists forecast better? Or maybe the extroverts forecast better? Or maybe it's people with very high IQs who forecast better? Well, none of those things was true. What was true was that the best forecast exhibited a particular state of mind. They were what the psychologists call actively open-minded thinkers. What does it mean to be actively open-minded? Basically, you're constantly looking for an excuse to get into an argument. Not because you want to prove that you're smarter, but because the moment you get into an argument, somebody else might teach you a lesson, and you really want to learn a lesson. You want people to disagree with you because that makes you smarter. You're happy to change your mind. You don't mind saying, oh, I was wrong then, and now I'm going to embrace better information. I mean, this is the kind of thing that we all like to tell ourselves we do, but of course we don't like to lose arguments. Of course we don't like to change our mind. This is quite unusual behavior, this actively open-minded thinking. But that was the leading predictor of whether someone was a super forecaster. Not their academic qualifications, not their intelligence, but their humility, their willingness to say, I was wrong, change my view, and hopefully the new view is going to do better. Now, that's important when we're thinking about evaluating our own forecasts and evaluating anybody else's forecasts. Because one of the things, unfortunately, the media will select for is confidence. A forecaster who never changes his mind and is constantly predicting the same thing with great confidence makes tremendous TV. You want to put this person in the newspapers. You want to put him in front of the cameras. But he's probably the very worst kind of forecaster to actually trust. But there's something else that really made me stop and think when I encountered Tetlock's work. It's that the same thing that Tetlock discovered in evaluating forecasters also gives us an advantage in another way. And to explore that advantage, I want to go back briefly to Fisher and Keynes. Because remember, where we left them, Fisher and Keynes had both made a catastrophic forecasting failure. They both completely failed to see the Wall Street crash coming and the Great Depression. But what I didn't tell you is how the story ends. Here's how it ends. Irving Fisher dies alone and near bankrupt, completely disgraced. John Maynard Keynes dies a millionaire. They make the same mistake, and yet things turn out so differently for them. Why? And the answer, very simply, is like Tetlock's super forecasters, John Maynard Keynes changed his mind. But that doesn't really get to the heart of the question. Why did Fisher stick to his guns, and why did Keynes change his mind? But to give you a sense of what Fisher was going through, he had shares in Remington Rand, the stationery company, at $89 a share at the beginning of the Wall Street crash. 3 months into the Wall Street crash, they had fallen to $29 a share. But at $29 a share, Fisher was continuing to borrow and buy more shares. Buy on the dips, is what he was telling himself. Eventually, those shares fell to just $1. If you're borrowing money to buy $29 shares that fall to $1, that is how, even as a millionaire, you can wipe yourself out. And it's painful to read the kind of things that Fisher was writing all the way through the crash, which the crash itself lasted nearly 4 years. He's writing, oh, it's just the froth being blown off the top of the market. Oh, there's no lasting damage done to the American economy. It's just the lunatic fringe shaking itself out. The market will bounce back soon. This is a buying opportunity all the way through as it went down and down and down and down. But why? Why didn't Fisher change his mind? I think it's partly different context and partly different character. So the context, the thing you really have to understand about Irving Fisher is that on the front page of the New York Times, 2 weeks before the Wall Street crash, Irving Fisher said, stocks have reached a new and permanently high plateau. He was totally publicly connected to his forecast. People during the Great Depression blamed the Wall Street mania on the Treasury Secretary, President Herbert Hoover, and Irving Fisher. That's how prominent Fisher was. And that matters because the more invested you are in your ideas, the harder it is to back away from them. when you are completely financially sunk in this idea, and when the whole world knows that you believe in this idea, it is almost impossible to step back. Keynes was in a very different situation. So Keynes, remember, had already lost a fortune and won a fortune. So Keynes knew it was no big deal. And Keynes was losing money privately. He was investing the resources of a Cambridge college rather than talking about his investment strategy in every newspaper in America. And the other thing about Keynes is Fisher, up until 1929, had every reason to believe he was a genius because he's making leveraged bets in a rising market. He's making more and more money. Whereas Keynes' strategy actually was failing before 1929. He was underperforming the market by about 20% over the course of his first 7 or 8 years investing. And so although he didn't see the Wall Street crash coming, although he didn't see the Great Depression coming, he saw that his strategy wasn't working. And he was already beginning to cast around for something new. So he's in a very different situation. And the strategy that he eventually adopted was much more, you know, pick a small number of value stocks with strong cash flow, management you understand, buy into them for the long term. That was his approach. It's now associated with Warren Buffett. And for Keynes, it was incredibly successful. So when his investment record was evaluated over the course of 25 years, including those initial 6 or 7 years where he was not very successful, the total investment record, he outperformed the market benchmark by 6% a year. It's not quite Warren Buffett level, but 6% a year for 25 years, I'd be happy. And I suspect most of you would as well. So his change of strategy was a success. But the other thing, it wasn't just the context. I think it was the character. So Irving Fisher is a person who believed inherently that life was predictable, that the social sciences, the economy, all of these imponderable things around us, if you had enough statistics, if you had enough data, if you had a good enough theory and you thought hard enough, in the end, you would be able to see into the future. The world was inherently predictable. One of his rivals during the crash said, Irving's problem, he thinks the world is ruled by numbers and it's really ruled by feelings. John Maynard Keynes never thought that. In a famous passage in his General Theory, he writes about forecasting long-term interest rates or the price of copper in 20 years' time. And he says, about these uncertainties, there is no scientific basis to form any probability whatsoever. We simply do not know. When he started investing on that basis, that we do not know, that is when he actually started to make money. When he was originally raising cash for his hedge fund back in 1920, he wrote to his father asking him for money and saying, win or lose, this high stakes gambling amuses me. Which is not necessarily the strategy you should approach if you're trying to raise money to invest, but it probably was an attitude that helped him. It helped him be agile. It helped him change his mind. As we've seen from Phil Tetlock's work, a willingness to question yourself and to change your mind makes for better forecasts. But perhaps more importantly, when your forecasts fail, which they will always from time to time, it helps you adjust and adapt and pick yourself up and do better next time. John Maynard Keynes and Irving Fisher both died within a few months of each other just after the Second World War. Fisher, as I said, alone, humiliated, near bankrupt. John Maynard Keynes, the most celebrated economist on the planet. His last words, apparently, were, I should have drunk more champagne. I'm going to remember him for something else, something he's often reported to have said. He probably never said it, but he did live by it. When my information changes, I change my opinion. What do you do? I wish he'd had the opportunity to teach that lesson to Irving Fisher. I'm very happy to take questions, but thank you very much for listening.
Thank you, Tim. We have time for a couple of questions. First point of clarification, everything in Canada is named after something here. Oxford is a county outside of Toronto. where Oxford Properties was founded, and I went to the University of Toronto, not Oxford.
Well, I mean, Toronto is, of course, one of the greatest cities in the world, but I live in Oxford, UK myself, where there is apparently a university as well. And so it's a good name anyway. We can agree it's a great name.
So thank you for your comments. I have a couple of provocative questions. As we sit yesterday and we listen to Michael Gove kind of find himself in a bit of a box about not having trusted or don't trust experts at the time of the Brexit pre-referendum. And then we have the OECD coming out yesterday and saying, oh, if we hadn't done this, we would be X. Kind of help me reconcile from where you sit, you know, great time to be an economist, great time to be a journalist, great time to be a trader, but if you're the government, if you're Oxford, or you're an investor, or you're the people in this room who are trying to navigate their way through, how do we reconcile ourselves?
Yeah, so what Gove actually said in that infamous remark is, and he was sort of interrupted halfway through, but if you listen to it, he said, I think the British public have had enough of experts. Well, I have to say he's probably right about that. The British public had enough of experts. I think the British public have had enough of experts from international institutions telling them what to think. So he was particularly going for the International Monetary Fund, the OECD, all these sort of international, supposedly independent experts, though of course one can always question the extent to which they were independent. The way that I think about how to use the expertise from, say, the IMF or the OECD is if you look at the point forecasts, like what their GDP forecasts are, those forecasts are normally pretty good, except when it matters. So generally the forecast is, well, it's going to be, next year will be a bit like this year, or if this year is really bad, next year will probably be a bit better. That's not a bad forecast, but you end up never, ever, ever predicting a recession. And the IMF basically never does predict recessions unless they're already in progress. That's not my opinion. That's the opinion of the IMF itself, evaluating its own forecasts, as it should do. So it's not very helpful to just look at the numbers coming out of the IMF or any other, because they're all the same, or any other forecasting house, public sector, private sector. They're all broadly the same. But what often is helpful is when you start looking at the qualitative list of risks. I remember giving a talk about the outlook for the world economy in early 2007, and I didn't have anything particularly insightful to say about GDP growth, but I listed the risks, and the risks mostly all came true. They came true in a much more spectacular way than I was anticipating, but I said, look, the banking system is fragile, there might be an oil price spike. I listed all this stuff, and I don't claim any great credit for this. I got the list from the IMF's World Economic Outlook. So very often, if you look qualitatively at what they're identifying, it's a bit of a shopping list, but it will often alert you to things that you might want to pay attention to. And if those things seem relevant to your own interests, it's worth digging a bit deeper. But the actual number, we need a number and we need it to be independent. I'd rather have the Office for Budget Responsibility making forecasts than have the Chancellor or the Treasury making forecasts. But that doesn't mean the Office for Budget Responsibility forecasts are going to be right. They never are. The best we can say of them is they're independent.
Why didn't you take part in the survey? You said you were too coward, but what was the reason?
Why didn't I take part in the survey? To be honest, it was I don't think that I have any special forecasting ability. But also, I think to do that survey justice did require a commitment of time. So either you had to be, some of the people who did very, very well, some of the super forecasters, basically people who were retired or just wanted an interesting hobby and would follow these forecast questions with great attention because, they found it interesting. Other people who were in the forecasting game were professional forecasters, CIA analysts, IMF economists, and so on. So I'm neither of those. So I don't want to forecast as a hobby, and I don't forecast as part of my job. And so I thought I'm just going to be noise in this survey, and I'll leave other people to work on it.
Hi, Tim. As was shown by the feature film The Big Short, there was... obviously some people in Wall Street, for example, Michael Burry, who made millions off shorting the bond market. And if they had changed their opinion when their information had changed, i.e. actually went against their favor for a while, he would have lost, you know, millions, even hundreds of millions as well. Do you think there are times, you know, maybe looking at Brexit, where you shouldn't change your mind even if the information does change?
I think it's a really interesting question. And in all kinds of walks of life, there is this balancing act between being, you know, flexible and just being, you know, inconstant. You know, you want to have the, you know, persistence and courage of your convictions to press on through, but at the same time, you don't want to be stubborn. And I don't think there's any easy answer to that question. But I do think that when you identify people like Michael Burry in the Big Short, which, by the way, now stars a Nobel Prize-winning economist as well, since Richard Thaler who won the Nobel Prize last week, is in the film. When you look at people like Michael Burry, it's striking that their forecasts really weren't macroeconomic. Their forecasts were based on a real detail orientation of what exactly was contained in the contracts and the details of, you know, who got paid, when, and under what conditions. And so Burry and some of the other investors who followed that short were basically saying that we're not even making a forecast. We have just looked at the detail, and there is zero chance that, you know, this money will be repaid. That was their kind of their thinking. Now, maybe to some extent they got lucky, and we were dealing with survivor bias and so on. But it's interesting that they abandoned macro forecasting in favor of looking at the details of things. And that often seems to be a powerful way forward. So Keynes, remember, prospered in the same way. He still had to make forecasts to make money as an investor, but he started making forecasts about, well, does this business have a competitive advantage? Do the managers of this business seem to know what they're doing? Do I trust them? Rather than, do I think there'll be a recession next year? When Keynes, when he was trying to forecast whether there'd be a recession next year, it was hopeless. Trying to forecast whether this particular copper mining company offered value for money, well, that's a forecast too, but it's a very different kind of forecast, and it did seem to work for him.
Do you think that sometimes there's a problem with understanding probability, in that unlikely things do happen, and when they do happen, it doesn't mean that the people who forecast them to be unlikely are wrong?
Yes. So Nate Silver, for instance, forecast there was about a 35% chance that Donald Trump would win the election. A lot of people say, well, Silver was wrong, because Donald Trump did win the election and Hillary Clinton was the favorite, not Trump. Other people would say, yeah, but everyone else said that Donald Trump was like a 99-1 outsider. And so Nate Silver was much closer to the result. And it's not even clear what it means to say that there's a 35% chance. I mean, really, 35% chance means if you ran 100 elections, Donald Trump would win 35 of them. But you don't run 100 elections, you only run one. So even understanding quite what the probability means can be difficult. You're absolutely right. Just because someone makes a forecast and the forecast doesn't come true doesn't mean that they didn't have good reasons to believe it. The power of Tetlock's approach is he has so many different forecasts, so many different questions evaluated on a day-by-day basis, that he, in the end, you can start to say sensible things about, you know, whether such and such a person is a good forecaster or not. Too often in the regular forecasting game, people are able to wiggle out and say, oh, well, I made the right mistake, or it was just off on the timing. Tetlock's method, I think, is unforgiving, inflexible, and it's powerful because of that.
Do you have any thoughts or opinions on cryptocurrencies?
Do I have any opinions on cryptocurrencies? I read a very interesting piece by the chief executive of Chain just last night, which expressed the view that they shouldn't even be called cryptocurrencies, they should be called crypto assets. They were a technology designed to allow decentralized processing of information. One of the things you might want to do with decentralized processing of information is to run a currency, but many, many other things going on. My general view is that these cryptographic technologies seem interesting. I don't really understand them. but they seem to offer possibilities. I'm very worried about the idea of simply investing in them as an asset right now. They seem very bubbly, very really, really open to scam artists. And the very fact that, if you look at the first one of them, Bitcoin, the very fact that it just sort of soars and crashes and soars and crashes, that's exactly what you don't want in a real currency. What you want in a real currency, above everything else, is predictable, predictability. You want it to be worth about the same tomorrow as it was yesterday. That's your basic thing. Everything else is just kind of is gravy. So as currencies, I'm a bit skeptical. As a useful technology that, you know, might be doing interesting things in future, yeah, maybe. It is slow. It is computationally expensive. There are lots and lots of reasons why you might not want to use crypto assets, but I suspect they will find uses in the long run. I'm just too stupid to see what they'll be.
Do you think artificial intelligence will allow us to program a super forecaster?
A super forecaster?
Yeah.
One interesting question. I think that AI is helping us get much better at forecasting data-rich events. So, and in fact, it's becoming so simple that we don't even really dignify it with the term AI anymore. So Amazon, for example, is very good at predicting how many copies of a particular new toy are going to be ordered, or if you cut the price of this book by 4%, how much will demand increase? I mean, that sort of thing. We've got lots and lots and lots of data, updatable by the second, even by the microsecond, if you want. And you make pretty good forecasts. There's still a certain amount of chaos in the system. There are still things you can't quite predict, but still, it's working very well. The bigger and more generic and more data poor and more complex the system, the harder it is to forecast. And so at the moment, I'm still a little skeptical about the possibility of artificial intelligence doing very much to improve our forecasts. I think we take it very seriously because it's mysterious and we don't fully understand it. And so we give it a little bit more credit than perhaps it deserves. There's a wonderful story in Gary Kasparov's new book, Deep Thinking, where he describes using machine intelligence to try to solve chess. So this idea is pure pattern recognition. We're not going to program the chess computer. We just get it to look at lots and lots of chess games and make a forecast about the best way to play. And when this artificial intelligence was unleashed, the first thing it did was immediately sacrifice the queen. And so everyone's trying to figure out why this computer is sacrificing the queen. And the answer is, well, I studied all the... But of course, the machine can't tell you. You have to figure it out. But the answer turns out to be, in all of these games, whenever a grandmaster sacrifices his or her queen, they then win shortly afterwards. But of course, that's why the only circumstances under which you sacrifice your queen are the circumstances in which you were anticipating winning shortly afterwards. So the machine spotted the pattern, had no idea what it meant, and then went on to play completely disastrously. So there's a lot of excitement there, a lot of power there, and it will change the world. But let's not get carried away with the hype. These forecasting problems, the macro forecasting problems, are inherently very, very difficult, even for computers, smart as they are.
Okay, Tim, last question. I'm trying to be wrapped up in a couple of minutes. So thank you for your comments. Thank you for your summary of the way that we try to use this information. I found it interesting, the question that came from the back about how people are adapting their strategies based on the information that's available. And I know we're all trying to do that based on data, whether we believe the data up, down, or sideways. So given that's where we're at, and given new information that's coming out, and this isn't going to be a prediction of data or not prediction, this is a real question, do you think the government will try to change their strategy based on the data that is coming out? And do you think that the people, based on the data that is coming out for us, will give them the support to actually do that? Because I think we all would rather end up like Keynes than end up like Fisher.
Yeah, I'd rather do that. I don't think the government knows what it's going to do. So I certainly don't know what it's going to do. It's easy to see what the sources of uncertainty are. Basically, there's this extreme political vulnerability, and Theresa May can be held hostage by Jeremy Corbyn or by the right wing of her own party or by the left wing of her own party. So I find the situation imponderable. I think that the it's worth sort of asking yourself in this circumstance, can we reverse engineer a situation where something really spectacular happens? The two spectacular scenarios to me would be a train crash, Brexit, out without a deal, just, you know, queues at the border, can't even fly the planes because we don't have the regulatory apparatus. Or the other thing to evaluate is the prospect, maybe this just doesn't happen at all and we never ever leave the EU. Both of these I think are unlikely but possible, and because they're possible it's worth sort of trying to reverse engineer how they happen. I think it's very easy now to see how a train crash happens. It's too easy to imagine. How would reversing Brexit happen? I guess you get to the point where the can is successfully kicked down the road for a couple of years, the mood of the British public turns, and somebody wins a general election with a promise to call a new referendum, and at that point, British public change their minds and decide they don't want to leave. I see a lot of stumbling blocks on the way to that scenario. I think it's unlikely, but I do think it's possible, and I think it's, you need to consider the unlikely as well as the central scenario. The big question is, will the British public change their mind? I don't know. I think it will. People will have to step away from their original vote, which takes time, to acknowledge that I've changed my mind about what I used to think. Fisher showed us how difficult it can be to change your mind, but given enough time, anybody can. And I guess we'll see. And that's all any economist can ever really tell you about the future. I guess we'll see.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, everybody, for your attention.
Thank you very much.